Welcome to Small Town Mysteries, a show where three longtime friends from Massachusetts tell crazy and heartbreaking true stories filled with the extra flair of small town mystery. I'm Kate, here with Christine.
Hello.
And Rachel.
Hello.
Bringing you our next episode on Catherine and Sheila Lyon. But before I get into that, I'm going to toss it over to Christine, who will be highlighting our missing person for this week.
Thank you, Kate. This week, I am highlighting Marquone Alexander. He has been missing from Dayton, Ohio since March 26, 2024. He is 14 years old. He is a black male. His height is 5'6". He weighs about 235 pounds. He has black hair and brown eyes. He was last seen in Dayton, Ohio on March 26th wearing black jeans, a gray t-shirt, and green shoes. If you have any information, contact Dayton Police Department at 937-333-2677. We will have that picture up on our Instagram at Small Town Mysteries Pod around when this episode drops, so keep an eye out from that if you live anywhere near the Dayton, Ohio area.
Thank you, Christine. Yes, as she said, at Small Town Mysteries Pod on Instagram, we will have the information up somewhere around the time the episode comes out. All right, I'm going to pass it over to Rachel, who is going to get into, I'm going to say it, the meat of the episode. Yeah. You can't see it, but they're both giving me dirty looks.
Yeah, gross. I hate it.
Yeah.
All right. So today I'm going to talk about Catherine Mary Lyon, who is 10 years old, and her sister Sheila Mary Lyon, who was 12 years old, who disappeared from a local mall in Wheaton, Maryland in March of 1975. The case went cold for 38 years. Eventually, a man named Lloyd Lee Welch Jr. was found guilty of kidnapping and the murders of the Lyon sisters, and Welch was only 18 years old at the time of the crime.
That's unusual.
So, just before I get into the abduction, I'm just going to quickly talk about the town of Wheaton, Maryland. Wheaton, Maryland is located in Montgomery County. The population in 2020 is about 52,000 people. So, not really a small town, but I also couldn't really find population data or census data or whatever from 75. So now I'm going to talk about the abduction. On March 25th, 1975, Catherine and Sheila Lyon visited their local mall in a suburb of Washington, D.C. They left their home right before noon with plans to go to Wheaton Plaza shopping mall, which was about a half a mile away from their home. It was the first day of Easter vacation from school, and the Lyon sisters wanted to go see the Easter exhibits at the mall. And they also wanted to have pizza at the Orange Bowl restaurant. There were multiple sightings of Catherine and Sheila at the mall that day. I'm just going to go in chronological order. At 1 p.m., the girls were seen talking to an unidentified man outside of the Orange Bowl restaurant I was just talking about, where they like to get pizza. The man was described as a 6-foot-tall man in his 50s, wearing a brown suit, and also carrying a briefcase that contained a tape recorder inside. Which I'm like, how would you know if it had a tape recorder in it? I feel like that's so random.
That's exactly what I was just wondering.
Yeah. No, me too. Here I am. I'm like, who has x-ray vision? Like, what?
Yeah, I want that.
I know, right? Gotta share your secrets.
Like, did they find the briefcase after the fact? Or did they know someone who, like, gave them info about that? Do you get into that?
Yeah, so allegedly this man had been spotted multiple times in the past few weeks, speaking to numerous children, asking them to read a message into the microphone hidden in the briefcase.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Yeah, that's scary.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those unfortunate red flags that to a child would seem innocuous.
Yeah.
Like, oh, definitely. He just wants me to say something real quick. Like, even as an adult, now in the age of, like, TikTok, I would be like, no, and then leave. But, like, I don't know. There's something about that is very innocuous and would not raise alarm bells immediately to, like, 13-year-old me.
Yeah, it's just something very specific. Mm-hmm. Do you know what the message he wanted them to say was? Or was it just, like, kind of a random type of message?
I'm not really sure what it was. The thing is, I think he did this a lot. Like, I don't think it was a one and done type of thing. I think he approached a lot of little girls. So my hunch is he made them say all types of things.
Okay.
So the next sighting was by their 15-year-old brother, who saw them eating pizza alone, just the two of them, at the Orange Bowl restaurant at 2 p.m. The last sighting of the girls was by a friend who saw them walking westward down Drum Avenue near Devon Street between 2:30 and 3:30. And this would have been the most direct route back to their house from the mall. Their mother had told them to be home by 4 p.m. When neither of them had arrived by 7 p.m., the Lyon family contacted police. So yeah, things really moved alarming. Pretty quickly. Yeah. Honestly, there was so much information in this case that I was overwhelmed, which is like very interesting because I feel like that's the complete end of the spectrum that I'm usually on.
I have had cases like that, though, where they might be more popular cases or just cases that have a lot of information. And sometimes with cases like that, it is hard because there's a lot of like discourse around the case and you don't necessarily know what's the truth and what's not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'll talk more about that once I get there's one piece of this case that's very kind of complicated. So I'll just get there when I get there. So now I'm going to move on to investigation and tips kind of early on. So a full search was conducted. I actually found a newspaper article from 1975 that described the helicopter searches for the Lyon sisters, which this is like kind of messed up, but like I got excited finding this article. I was like, this is so cool, like getting to see this from like 1975. Mm-hmm. But then I'm like, I'm literally smiling about an article that's talking about a helicopter search for two young girls.
I'm gonna validate that though, because I also get that surge of like, oh, whenever I find a really good primary source. So I am not judging you for this. I totally get it. And it's not anything to do with the substance of the article you find. It's the existence of it that is so beneficial and helpful. Yeah. No, I'm not. I don't fault you for that at all. Totally been there.
All right. So along with helicopter searches, the woods were thoroughly searched along with various storm sewers and every vacant house for miles. Scuba divers trudged through muds at the bottom of ponds. Everyone did everything that they could, but sadly, they were unsuccessful. The one great thing about this is people acted so fast in this. Like, it was clearly such a quick turnaround, like, for looking for these children, which is amazing to see because we've covered so many cases where police are like, oh, give it 24 hours, or, oh, we'll talk about it later.
Or worse, we don't even investigate until it's been 48 hours. And then it's like, well.
Or they ran away. That's
right. Or they just ran away, so we're not going to investigate. Right. It is good to see a prompt response.
Yeah. I think it definitely did help. Like, their ages were a little bit younger, so that probably did help the matter. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
But I do wonder if it would have been different if they were like 16 and 17 or like 14 and 16, how mm-hmm. the response would have been different.
I also think 2 versus 1 changed it as well.
Right.
Because especially like this was 1975. Like they didn't see a lot of crime like this. It was kind of unheard of. So to have 2 girls go missing.
I'm just like trying to think of how this all is going to connect. Because I just realized that you said an 18-year-old was convicted, but the man was in his 50s.
No, I know.
Intrigue.
That he was described as in his 50s. I'm going to get into that, but I honestly think it's because he didn't take care of his appearance.
So he was actually 18?
A young guy who like looked like crap.
Wait a second. Was he 18 and he was described as in his 50s?
I think that's what happened.
That is rough.
That's the picture. That's him.
Are you
not 18?
Smoking? That's okay.
Are you kidding?
Okay, but
no. I wouldn't say 50.
The real person, like the picture of the real person, he's definitely not 50. Like, if anything, I would say like 20s.
25.
Like, but 50s? Who is describing this man? Dude, what did they think a 50-year-old looked like? Like, nowadays, at least we have plastic surgery and people are like, well, maybe that skewers things. But back then, you had nothing.
Yeah, when you were in your 50s, you were 1 foot in the grave, apparently. Because this guy has, like, a shit-eating mustache, and apparently that makes him a full-ass adult.
He also has a full head of hair, okay?
But that, I feel like, was the era.
Okay, yes. Maybe he was, like, wearing the full bandana, too, and people were like, oh, who knows what he got going on under that bandana.
He could have a receding hairline and male pattern baldness, and we would never know.
But that's very that just really shows you that eyewitness is just not great.
No, I know. 100%.
Wow.
It's hard because, like, it's believed that Tape Recorder Man is Welch. So, like, it goes back and forth. And I feel like sometimes that was hard for me to keep up with. So someone said that they had seen Welch staring at the two girls, like, extremely intensely, to the point where a friend of the Lion Sisters approached him in the mall and questioned, like, what he was doing. The friend provided a description of Welch, which was late teens or early 20s, long hair, acne scars, and dressed poorly.
So that's a lot more aligned with what we then found out he was, and a lot less man in his 50s with a briefcase, which was the original description. Okay, yes. That definitely is a better description, fitting with the 18-year-old's, well, and I've seen the picture now, so with the bandana and the long hair, like, the acne scars, that just tracks.
So a sketch was created and does look, like, similar to Welch, I would say. Like, it's not a spitting image, but I can see a resemblance.
It's one of the better ones I've seen.
Yeah, there is, like, definitely something there. Mm-hmm. Also, I did look on Wikipedia because I was curious, and it says the source. I think you said this too. It was, like, a neighborhood boy that described him as in his 50s.
Okay.
So I wonder if he was just, like, a really young kid that was,
that could have been it.
Everyone is ancient.
Everyone. Like, he's 50 years old.
I do feel like kids have two modes when they talk about age, and it's like, everyone older than me is 16, mm-hmm. or everyone older than me is 50.
Yeah.
And there's, like, no in between.
Yep, that definitely is what happened.
All right, so here's another eyewitness statement. On April 7th, 1975, a witness in Manassas, Virginia, reported seeing girls that looked like Sheila and Catherine in the back of a beige 1968 Ford station wagon. The witness claimed to see them around 7:30 a.m. and stated that they were bound and gagged.
Wait, I'm sorry. Did this person immediately report this?
Okay, I was going to say that.
Actually, okay, I'm going to get into it, but this person even, like, went so far to follow them. So, like, they did their due diligence.
Okay. I'm just thinking, how do you report this? Like, oh, yeah, that's right. 48 hours ago, I did see two women bound and gagged. And, like, sir.
No, this person actually even, like, went as far as to following them, which is obviously not even, I would argue that's not your duty to do.
No, I think probably the wise response to that is to call authorities and not take matters into your own hands.
But at the same time, if I saw that, I think I almost would follow to see where they were going while I would be on the phone with the police.
Yeah.
The thought that I was right behind that person and could have, like, seen where they were going or told the police, like, exactly where they were going versus me just being like, oh, I'm going to just call the police and then maybe they'll find them. Maybe they won't.
Yeah. I feel like it would depend very heavily, like, if I was also in a car, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If I was in a car.
If I was, like, on foot and I saw something on foot, I don't think I would, like, run after someone because I'm very aware of my limitations as a human being and the fact that I am 5 feet tall and would probably just get abducted again, as they would think I was, like, a third teenager.
They'd be like, oh, yeah, she's 12.
And I'm like, I'm 26. Like, and they're like, shut up.
They're like, sure, like,
that's not exactly appropriate to joke about, but I do feel like I would be aware of my limitations in that regard.
So the man driving the vehicle resembled the man seen talking to the children at the Orange Bowl restaurant the day the sisters disappeared. The witness followed the station wagon, but the driver noticed that he was being followed, and therefore he ran a red light and sped west on Route 234 towards Interstate 66 in Virginia. The car had Maryland license plates with a possible combination of DMT-6. However, the last two numbers were unknown since the car plates were bent, making it illegible. Originally, this report was considered credible, but later it was deemed questionable by police. So I don't know. I feel like there were so many different tips and everything. Like, I probably could be here for hours telling you about all the different ones. All right. This part's going to make you both upset, so I just need you to take a deep breath.
I appreciate the warning.
I will not take a deep breath because I like being upset.
I was just going to say, but I am not taking a deep breath.
All right, so now I want to talk a bit more about the sketch of the Tape Recorder Man. That sketch was not really shown to the public. It wasn't distributed among police enforcement, or media. And I personally believe if police had access to it, this all might have went differently.
Wait, so it wasn't that shown to police?
Yeah, that's
apparently, like, odd. I don't know exactly how it happened. Like, I'm not really sure if it just, like, didn't get there quick enough or what.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not like they could just email it, but still.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially with so much of the response being prompt, immediate, to then have something as seemingly minimal as not distributing a sketch to law enforcement officers seems like a big misstep.
Yeah. So a week after the investigation started, the media printed a description of the tape recorder man. Just a description, not a picture. The day that this was printed, Welch went to the police station and claimed that he had witnessed the abduction.
Oh.
I know this. I literally wrote, this is such a facepalm moment. I don't know any other way to describe it.
That is frustrating, because if they had the sketch, do you think they would have recognized him? Like,
well, I'm going to give a little bit of a foreshadowing here.
Oh, no.
But how they ended up finding him later on, like, the cold case detectives ended up looking through and found a picture of him and compared it to the sketch and was like, oh, and then realized he also had a very lengthy history and kind of went from there.
Okay.
So it is possible.
So there's a decent chance that they would have recognized him if they had access to the sketch. Now I'm angry.
I mean, that it's incredibly stupid, but obviously an attempt by him to deflect and be like, oh, I'm involved in this and I am trying to do the right thing. It's not me. Why would it be me? Why would I come to the police office when I was actually the one who did it?
I just happened to also be there. People thought they saw me. Weird. That's because I was there, but I didn't take them. You know, like, it seems on the surface like a decent attempt at deflecting suspicion. And I don't know, feels like perhaps it worked, at least at that point.
But it came back to bite him in the ass.
Eventually, of course, yes.
No, it definitely did.
Ugh. Karma's a bitch.
All right, so here's what Welch told police. He was at Wheaton Plaza and witnessed the tape recorder man talking to the two girls. He then saw the man forcibly shove the two girls into his car before speeding away. Investigators gave Welch a lie detector test, which he failed. But obviously, we've talked about this before. They're bogus, so it doesn't really matter anyway. Eventually, Welch admitted to lying about witnessing the abductions. However, since police didn't have the sketch, they didn't make the connection, even though Welch was a traveling carnival worker who was dressed poorly, had long hair, and acne scars. All right. I just briefly want to talk about what the Lyon family had to endure, honestly. I don't want to talk about it too much in detail because it's really fucked up. And it just guarantees the F word.
If it's warranted, it's warranted.
It's necessary because multiple people called the Lyon family stating that they had their daughters and were requesting ransom money in exchange for their daughter's safe return.
Yeah, that's fucked up.
Multiple. One caller demanded that their father leave behind a briefcase containing $10,000 in an Annapolis, Maryland courthouse restroom. The money was never collected. The caller later claimed that the police had surrounded the courthouse, making it impossible to retrieve the money. Which, like, I don't know also, why you would have somebody put money there.
Why would you choose a courthouse for your illegal scheme? That's a questionable decision at best. And stupid at worst.
Yeah, I don't know. Before the family would give the man the money again, they demanded to see proof of life of the girls. The caller said he would be in touch and then just never contacted them again. So this was just some asshole.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I just... you're a whole new level of scum if you do that.
Yeah, there's absolutely nothing redeemable about exploiting the family of missing children for your own potential financial gain. Like, just taking someone at their worst and kicking them even more when they're down. Like, there's nothing even close to redeemable about that. You're just a shitty person at that point. And the fact that multiple people did it is disturbing.
Now we're moving forward to 2013. Where the cold case was finally reopened, 38 years later. While looking through the files, Sergeant Chris Homrock discovered Welch's original statement. He noticed that his mugshot had matched the tape recorder man sketch. In addition, he focused on the witness statements pertaining to this man talking to the Lyon sisters. Detectives learned that Welch had a horrific criminal history between the years 1973 and 1977 for various offenses such as rape, domestic violence, and assault with a knife. On top of all of that, he was currently serving out a 29-year sentence at James T. Vaughn Correctional Center for molesting a 10-year-old girl in Delaware.
Oh, that's a real winner.
From 73, so he was at 75 when he abducted them. He was 18, so he had like this horrific history since he was 16 years old.
On October 16th, 2013, Detective Dave Davis traveled with Homrock and Montgomery Deputy State's Attorney Pete Feeney to Dover, Delaware to interview Welch. The first thing Welch said when the men entered the room was, "I know why you're here. You're here about the two missing girls." And he had a sly grin plastered on his face.
Gag.
Disgusting. During the first session, Welch denied any involvement in the Lyon girl abductions. Here's a quote from him. Quote, "I didn't kill anybody. I didn't rape anybody. I didn't do nothing to those girls. I mean, I really don't have much to tell you."
Sorry, it's just weird that he would say, like, "Oh, I know why you're here," and then be like, "I didn't have anything to do with it."
You know what that reminds me of is Josh Duggar, throwback to last summer. When the feds first picked up Josh Duggar during the raid on his car lot, he said, "What's going on? Has someone been downloading child pornography here?"
Yeah.
And it was like, that's so specific. Why would you even suggest that?
Also, this specific crime from like decades ago. Like, oh, yeah, that's why you're here. I didn't do it. It's honestly, it is a shame that it took decades to convict this guy because he was so clearly extremely dense.
I guarantee he just like slipped up and told someone at a bar one time.
Oh, yeah.
Like years earlier, and the guy just forgot or something.
Or was,
like,
yeah, too drunk.
Right. Like, there's no way this guy made it this long without absolutely just slipping up and like telling everyone that he knew about this. Like, that's so frustrating.
So Welch kept talking, and after a full day of questions, he allowed something to slip that stood out to detectives, which is very similar to what you just said, Kate, actually. Police believe that Welch had either witnessed or even possibly assisted in the girl's abduction by a pedophile named Ray Molesky. Detectives asked Welch what he thought Molesky did to the girls. He said, quote, "Well, my opinion is that he killed them, raped them. He killed him, and he probably burned him. I don't know."
Now, what purpose does that serve in deflecting suspicion off of him? It doesn't. If anything, I hear that, and I'm like, okay, cool. Change some pronouns there, and that's a confession.
Yeah.
The burn, like, what?
Why would you bring that up?
No, you wouldn't, unless that's what actually happened.
Yes. So he proceeded to lie in further sessions. However, eventually he admitted to helping kidnap the girls, but was adamant that others in his family were in charge. He first named his cousin, then uncle, and then his father. So police questioned Welch's cousin, Henry Parker, who admitted to assisting Welch in disposing of two heavy duffel bags in 1975.
Oh, God.
It gets worse. Parker said that each bag weighed about 60 or 70 pounds and smelt like death. And Parker just said that he threw the bags into the fire without ever looking inside. Just, that was it. They ended up not being able to charge him with anything. I think there just, like, wasn't quite enough evidence.
It's just weird, though, that he admitted. I mean, wait, no, I have a question. And I think you can answer it because you unmuted yourself and you were ready. But
I was ready.
If a person says all this stuff, like, they disposed of these heavy bags, it smelled like death, they were heavy, but they never looked inside it, would that count as, like, aiding and abetting? Or because, like, they did not like say that they knew that there was a dead body inside, even though like all signs point to the fact that like, hello, there's a dead body inside. Could they be convicted?
So that is a kind of a complicated subject, as most things are in law, and is also like specifically tested on the bar exam about like intent of an agent acting on behalf of a principal. Okay. So like there is an argument to be made that if they didn't know what they were disposing of, perhaps they would not be charged. And sometimes that's like leveraged to get more information on the principal. But that doesn't seem to be what happened in this case. They just weren't charged. Yeah, I mean, the principal agent sort of liability question is definitely a bit more complicated than I could get into right now. But the answer is it depends, like most things in law. I do, I'm thinking about his theoretical, like, oh, I think they burned them and kidnapped them and killed them. And that's giving O.J. Simpson to me. When he wrote a book called If I Did It, and because it was all technically if,
right,
it's not a confession. Like, that's exactly what this feels like to me.
The gall, the absolute gall,
the nerve he had
in releasing that is wild.
The unmitigated nerve.
But you know, insane. That's not what we're here for.
Correct. That's not what we're here for. It's bold when anyone does it. It was bold when that jerk did it. It's bold now in this case.
Yep.
And it's certainly a decision that these people have made in their lives. And it's insane to me that it didn't bite them in the butt sooner.
All right. So police also heavily investigated Welch's father for any involvement in the Lyon case. However, he maintained that he was innocent and played no role. So this is the point where things get kind of confusing. At least it was difficult for me because he had so many different stories that he told. So obviously, like, I could be here forever telling every story that he told investigators. But the thing is, what is so freaking cool about this case is the police work that went into this, because basically what they did was they just listened very carefully to what this man said, and they were able to kind of pick the real truths out of what he said, like, in each spot, and then, like, piece it together and, like, actually find where he most likely murdered the girls and where he most likely burned their bodies. This article refers to the investigators as the squad. And honestly, I'm going to call them that because I think that's pretty awesome.
I love that.
I know, right? In the summer of 2014, the squad started to look through every member of the Welch clan. The clan was separated into two branches, one being in Hyattsville, Maryland, and the other 5 hours southwest in a hilltop in Thaxton, Virginia, called Taylor's Mountain. Incest was common about the clan that lived in Maryland.
We're talking about clans? The Welch clan? So this guy's, like, brethren and, like, family?
Yeah, it was not uncommon for Welch children to participate in sexual activities with siblings and cousins.
Okay, so his...
Him, like, as a child, his... Yes.
What?
Yeah.
So this was, like, normalized from an early age.
I would say, yeah.
The whole family was fucked up. Yeah. That's a justifiable use of that word.
Justifiable fuck.
When, like, incest is a thing, like, that's justifiable. I'm sorry. Gross. Disgusting.
And this was Maryland?
Yep.
Yeah, this is Sweet Home Maryland, apparently. Okay, so that is necessary background for why this man is the way that he is. Perhaps.
It definitely played a role. But at the end of the day, it's like, it's one of those things, like, you still have to be responsible for your crimes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course. Of course. It's an explanation, not an excuse.
I honestly probably could have learned a lot more about this if I really wanted, but this is all I wanted. I didn't even want this.
Yeah. Too much.
Too much.
But it definitely is, like, necessary, like Kate said. It's information necessary here, yeah. Context.
It was also possible that the Lyon sisters had become part of this cesspool, which Welch did claim at some point. but I don't think that actually did happen. I really don't. And this also made the squad theorize that maybe like family members were involved. I believe that it was probably just him, but I also wouldn't be surprised if his family members did help in like disposing things and maybe knew a little more than they let on. But I think for the most part, he did it by himself. But obviously you guys can come to your own conclusions. So at this point, Welch was claiming that Uncle Dick was responsible for planning the girl's abduction, and he denied any involvement in what happened to the Lion Sisters. He then claimed that he saw his father and uncle rape one of the Lion Sisters and dismember the other's body in the basement of their property. The squad decided to go check out the Hyattsville residence, because, you know, makes sense. In May of 2015, investigators went searching for the place where Welch claimed that his uncle Dick had killed and dismembered Kate before shoving her remains into a duffel bag and then ordering Welch to bring it to Taylor's Mountain and burn it. Welch claimed that Dick often went there to fish, drink, and smoke. It was Dick's comfort area. Welch was 90% sure about this, which I feel like is just such a random thing to include.
Yeah.
Like, I am 90% sure about this. Like, that just makes you seem more sketchy.
You know, he already seemed sketchy, like, early on. But yeah, that's another thing that's just like, what are you doing? What are you talking about?
So Dick's old house was razed in order to make room for new district court building. Dave knew where it had been, and he headed there first. Right away, Welch's story was not adding up. The last place you would take two young girls who are the center of a bi-county manhunt would be to this house. Especially because this address was only a stone's throw away from the city's police headquarters.
That's what I was just going to ask, is if it was a good location for a district court, there's got to be other law enforcement adjacent activities happening in that area. That would be a very odd place to take a kidnapping victim. And or two,
yeah,
as it were.
So that was obviously out because officers were around all the time. So Dave then checked out Buchanan Street, which Welch had also mentioned that his family had once lived on. He drove along the road until a dead end that looked into water. To the left, Dave saw a rail bridge that angled across the water. He climbed the fence and headed down into the water. It was evident that this was the place that Welch had described. As he drove up Buchanan Street again, he noticed a house that he recognized from snapshots in the file located across busy Baltimore Ave. Welch's father, Lee, and his wife, Edna, lived in this house. The address of the house was 4714 Baltimore Ave. Instant connection, because this is the address Welch had given in his original statement. So it's all kind of coming together now. Welch described watching his Uncle Dick pull out of the driveway with the Lion Sisters in the car and then headed toward a river. The detective immediately went across the street and knocked on the house. After looking around the house, Dave was able to conclude that this is where he had kept the two girls. There were two rooms that were disconnected from the main house, allowing privacy so no one would be able to hear or see anything. Dave came back the next day with a forensic team. After clearing some debris from the back room, they squirted Blue Star Spray, which I just didn't know the name of it. Blue Star Spray is a blood detection agent that bonds with hemoglobin and glows under blue light.
Didn't know that name either.
Yeah, same. No idea.
The room lit up. It was clear that somebody had been murdered in this room. However, the blood was too degraded to actually determine a match. So, of course, they also searched Taylor Mountain. In the search of Taylor Mountain, they discovered several tiny degraded bone fragments of human origin, a single human tooth, a piece of charred wire, possibly originating from Sheila's wire frame glasses, the remnants of a beaded necklace or bracelet similar to the one that Catherine frequently wore. The bones were too degraded to provide any form of DNA analysis, and the tooth was lost before any analysis could be done.
Oh my God. You just quite literally lose, like, the single most important piece of evidence you have. Hello? The
only piece of evidence.
How is that
literally the only physical evidence they had Okay.
I hope that it was just like, oh, I found this tooth. And then it was like, ah, it stumbled out of my hands. Where did it go? And not like, oh, we found this tooth. We put it in a bag. It got lost in the shuffle. Like, what happened to it? What are you doing?
Take better care of your important evidence.
Disheartening.
Yep. So to this day, Catherine and Sheila's remains have never been recovered. It is believed that their remains were burned and buried on Taylor Mountain in Bedford County, Virginia. So just a little tiny bit about Lloyd Lee Welch Jr. Welch was an Appalachian native who had a violent temper. Welch was exposed to incest in both a consensual and non-consensual manner at a young age. He was raised in foster care by his father after his mother died during a drunk driving accident that his own father was responsible for. He also claimed that he was repeatedly molested by his father as a child.
Raised in foster care by his dad?
I think it went, like, one point he was in foster care and one point he was being raised by his dad.
Oh,
okay. He was raised in part in foster care and in part by his father.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I was like, isn't that just what, like, single moms are called?
Isn't that
just, like, a single dad?
Parenting?
Like, isn't that just what you have to do?
Seems odd, parenting. But...
yeah.
So he clearly had, like, a really fucked up childhood. And my hunch is he showed, like, really early signs. So I just want to talk a little bit about Welch's pattern of abuse. He had an extensive history of abuse. After news broke about the Lyon sisters, 10 women came forward and agreed to testify that they were either attacked or nearly kidnapped by Welch. And then here are some testimonies from victims of Welch. A woman who is now in her 50s came forward. At the time, when she was 12, she was approached by Welch outside a record store at the mall. Welch told her that he was an undercover police officer and had just witnessed his brother steal a transistor radio from the record store. Welch told the girl that she needed to come to the parking lot with him to talk about the problem and that he wasn't trying to get anyone in trouble. Of course, the girl said that they needed to get her mother, but Welch convinced the girl that her mother was not needed and they could figure it out between themselves. The girl yelled for her brothers, who came running. She then patted down her brother's pockets to show that he hadn't stolen anything. And when she turned around, poof, Welch was gone. Around this time, Welch had gotten his girlfriend pregnant. Allegedly, in a fit of rage, this man kicked his pregnant girlfriend in the stomach, sending her into premature labor. And then in July of 1997, he was living with a woman and he sexually abused her 10-year-old girl, her 10-year-old daughter. And that's just some of it. So on to trial and sentencing. Initially, Welch denied any involvement in the Lyon case. He was indicted on first-degree murder charges. Eventually, after the lengthy police investigation, he confessed and took a plea. Welch had conveyed his fear about the death penalty, so it's not surprising that he eventually decided to take a plea, especially since Virginia is a death penalty state. On September 12, 2017, Welch pled guilty to 2 counts of felony murder. He continued to deny that he raped and killed the girls. However, his confession fell within the confines of a Virginia legal doctrine that defines murder as a killing in the commission of abduction with intent to defile. As part of his plea deal, Welch also pled guilty to 2 sexual assaults committed on children in the 1990s that were completely unrelated from the Lyon sisters. While investigating the Lyon case, police learned about these 2 assaults.
So they were not known before?
He just confessed to them.
Okay. All right.
This is a pattern, I feel like, with men like this is... they can still get a rise out of people even though they're behind bars.
Like, he's proud of it.
Yeah.
He's proud of what he's done, and he wants people to know.
Exactly.
Yeah, disgusting.
Oh, I mean, make no mistake, that's why he went to the police in the first place and claimed that he was in the vicinity when it happened. He wanted people to know that he was involved. They didn't figure it out.
At 60 years old, he was sentenced to 48 years in prison. Meaning that he would for certain die in prison. Good riddance. Yeah.
Fine by me.
I want to kind of get out anything else we have to say about this man before I just talk a little bit about Catherine and Sheila, because I just want to leave it remembering them rather than remembering this fucking asshole.
I have nothing else to say about this man.
Catherine and Sheila were born in Kensington, Maryland, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C., to John and Mary Lyon. Catherine Mary Lyon was born on March 29th, 1964, and Sheila Mary Lyon was born on March 30th, 1962. Isn't that crazy how close?
Very. Yeah.
John was a well-known popular radio star at WMAL-FM. In 1975, when the Lyon sisters went missing, Sheila went to Newport Junior High School and Catherine went to Oakland Terrace Elementary. Both of the girls' birthday was coming up and their parents had promised to make them like a meal of their choice. And they were both so excited and they couldn't stop talking about it. John Lyon thanked cold case detectives and law enforcement officers for their persistent efforts to bring those responsible for his daughter's abduction and murder to justice, saying, quote, "We just want to say thank you. It's been a long time."
I think it is nice that her parents were still alive to kind of see this through, to get at least some sort of small justice. I think that's great, because a lot of the times in cold cases like these, we see people pass away without knowing. And I think that's a shame.
I agree. I also feel like, obviously, I can't say for sure because I've never been in a position like that. But I feel like somebody in that position would fight to stay alive just to hear about like what happened. And like once you like heard that news, like you'd be able to be at peace.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you scroll down to the next page, there is pictures of them when they were younger and then age progress pictures of like what they would look like today, because they were missing for a long time. Yeah, that is the brutal murder of Catherine and Sheila Lyon.
Once again, thank you for breaking my heart.
Really sad on so many levels.
It's really tough because there are so many red flags and like,
right.
I really do believe that he could have been stopped before. But it also is, I don't know if nice is the right word, but when they did find him, he was already in prison.
Mm.
So there's that, but mm-hmm. It should have been sooner.
Yeah, and there's also, he was in prison, but you think about like, if they had caught him, he might not have been in prison for the crimes that he committed. And so there's also that fact of the matter, is that it could have been prevented other things in the future.
Right. That's what I was thinking, is all the things that he did in between this kidnapping and murder, and then when he was apprehended later for a later crime, those could have all been prevented.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm still pissed off about the freaking sketch that never got properly distributed. Like that, I will be angry about that for the rest of the night.
I just don't know how that happened. I really don't.
I want to say I think that could be an understandable oversight, but I really just don't think it's understandable at all. I feel like that's pretty damn important.
Yeah, it's puzzling.
Yes, it is. All right. Well, thank you for tuning into Small Town Mysteries. We'll be back next week with another mystery in a small town, depending on whose episode it is and how loyal they are to the concept of small town mysteries. That being said, I think it's Christine, and she's usually decent about this. So we'll have a nice Christine episode for you guys next week. In the meantime, you can reach us at Small Town Mysteries Pod on Instagram. We love to hear from our listeners. If you live in a small town, live near a small town, wish you lived in a small town, have previously heard of a small town, and or have a case you just want us to cover that has nothing to do with a small town, send us a DM. We'd love to hear about it and maybe add it to our list of cases to cover. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you guys next week.
Come spiral with us next week.
Bye.
Bye. I cut off early on that one.
Sure did.